I found our talks are very similar, but now I found you're focusing more on film and I'm focusing more on the novel, which was the weak side of my talk, but now that's good, I guess. So I'm talking about the transmedia translation of intertextuality and meta-reference from McEwan Settlement to Wright Settlement. This is how I will proceed. I will analyze Atonement as a case of mise en reflet. I will talk about the nature of novelistic discourse and film language a bit, and then Michael Bachtin's notion of novelistic discourse and Werner Wolf's categories for metafiction are going to form the basis for my analysis of the transmedia translation. And finally, I'll try to conclude what all of this means or might mean for the implied worldviews of the two atonements. For ease of reference, my slides are numbered, and I will gladly supply a bibliography if anybody's interested. So when preparing my talk for this conference, I found that my initial, and I think common, interpretation of atonement's communication structure as a case of an ascending metalepsis in the Tunisian sense was flawed. Why? The character Young Bryony is not the autodiegetic narrator, Old Bryony, of course. It's a feigned metalepsis that only works if the reader reproduces Bryony's confusion of fiction and reality. Structurally, there is no paradoxical transgression between the two parts of Atonement, which is Bryony's novel, and London 1999. The first is a projection of her desires, the latter a report of events in the textual actual world in which their shared author is situated, novelist Bryony. I argue we have here a case of mise en reflet, that is, two texts appearing on the same diegetic level, one illuminating a certain aspect of the other. In contrast to its well-known counterpart, mise en abîme, mise en reflet does not involve a hierarchy of diegetic levels. Atonement features two hyper-diegetic texts, and they're embedded in a silent frame story which reads, once an author wrote a novel which she did not publish, and then she wrote a diary entry discussing the making of that novel. Here they are. What do you think of them? Thus they acquire additional metafictional meaning. And the question really is, why are these texts set next to each other? And this is the question we've asked in, with regard to Sweet Tooth before. The question of publication. Were these texts actually published within the diegetic world, or are they only accessible to us as readers? Consider this quote from London 1999. As long as there is a single copy, a solitary typescript of my final draft, then my spontaneous, fortuitous sister and her medical prince survive to love. If Bryony's intention is the rewriting of her personal history, she would hardly undermine this project with a metafictional postscript. She is not responsible, I hold, for the juxtaposition of the two texts. Furthermore, Bryony's novel is drawing attention to its own constructedness in a way that is incongruent with this project. As James Wood has remarked, there's something fishy from the start. And the same applies to the revelatory London 1999, I argue, with its climatic design, rhetorical and equivocal statements about the true fate of her lovers. The two texts are imbued with certain overtones, and they're combined within a larger structure, which forces them to illuminate themselves and reveal themselves, I claim. And there is a higher, however invisible, narratorial instance that isn't Bryony. Now, Michael Bachtin calls such an instance the moment of the author-creator, which is the structural semantic impetus of a work as a whole utterance. To him, the resulting double-voicedness is one of the constitutive features of novelistic discourse, which he describes as an unfinalizable dialogue between languages as worldviews. Connotative meaning often dominates in literature. In contrast, James Monaco writes, the screen image is vested with an immutable aura of validity. verbal discourse cannot make such a strong claim for factuality. And let me illustrate. This is how characters look like in novels, and this is how they look like... other way around. In film, this is how they look like in novels. It's a banal effect, of course. The signs of film are iconic signs, the signs of language are symbolic signs. But both media are capable of storytelling. And this has consequences, I would argue, for the implied worldviews of the two texts. According to Bakhtin, novels offer us not so much characters or plot, but images of languages, which are always already evaluative. He describes the novel as a secondary speech genre because it is capable of incorporating other primary speech genres. Think of the speech genre of letter writing in the epistolary novel. It does not fulfill the function of an actual letter. It is employed for a certain purpose. It is saying something, but also saying something about itself. It is represented as representing. In Bakhtin, all utterances are hybrid constructions, relating to preceding utterances and anticipating those to follow. The words we use are always someone else's, and an unfinalizable dialogue between different worldviews takes place not between utterances, but within them. And artistic hybrid constructions, that is, novels, intentionally stage this internal dialogue. Others have then, in the wake of Bakhtin, termed this phenomenon intertextuality. Now let's look at an example of intertextuality, probably the most famous one, the figures by the fountain. So he began to unbutton his shirt. Immediately she knew what he was about, intolerable. She kicked off her sandals, unbuttoned her blouse and removed it, unfastened her skirt and stepped out of it and went into the basin wall. He stood with hands on his hips and stared as she climbed into the water in her underwear. Denying his help, any possibility of making amends, was his punishment. She held her breath and sank, leaving her fanned out across the surface. Drowning herself would be his punishment. A few pages later, we get the same scene from Riley's vantage point. Robbie imperiously raised his hand now, as though issuing a command which Cecilia dared not disobey. At his insistence, she was removing her clothes, and at such speed, while he looked on impatiently, hands on hips. What a strange power did he have over her? Blackmail? Threats? Cecilia, mercifully still in her underwear, was climbing into the pond, was standing waist-deep in the water, was pinching her nose, and then she was gone. And later we get Robbie's recollections of the events at the fountain. He sifted through unfamiliar feelings and returned to certain memories again and again. Nothing paused. Now and then, an inch below the water's surface, the muscles of his stomach tightened involuntarily as he recalled another detail. A drop of water on her upper arm, wet. An embroidered flower, a simple daisy, sewn between the cups of her bra, her breasts wide apart and small. On her back, a mole half covered by a strap. He groaned again at the memory of how she had taken off her clothes in front of him, so indifferently, as though he were an infant. Of course, he saw it clearly now. The idea was to humiliate him. Atonement here quotes, so to say, the voice of the modernist narrative technique, the psychological mode, as Briney refers to it, the shifting focalization and emphasis on internal action. This is employed here in order to tell a story, of course, but the technique itself is also exhibited as precisely that, a technique, because within the dialogic structure of the work, as we've heard before, it stands not alone and is brought into contact with other images of languages, other literary discourses. Now, how was this intertextual quotation translated to film? The montage of various perspectives is easily achieved by editing in film. In this particular respect, modernism was also inspired by cinema. So we get, this is Briney's point of view, this is Cecilia's, obviously, and then this is Robbie's point of view while he's thinking about Cecilia. And here we can see already what's missing, namely the internal action. At times, the mise-en-scène dwells on certain peculiar details, like the wasp, for example. But the character's thoughts we have to guess as viewers. The factual authority of the visual image, I argue, does not allow for an interpretation of it as a character's evaluation of an external reality, which is pretty much the essence of modernist fiction. McEwan's Atonement is writing its way through whole history of literature. An abundance of intertextual references has been discussed since its publication, and it's in its polyphonic orchestration of these, the novel evokes a dialogue between their worldviews. Various modes of written discourse or speech genres might be imitated in film, as we've seen, but they cannot be implemented as verbal discourse, as themselves, and thus reveal themselves by coming into dialogic contact with other discourses. Wright's Atonement will not make you reflect on the aptitude of modernist fiction for representing reality in comparison to other literary modes. So, literature, talking about literature, this obviously brings me to my next point in argument, metafiction, or meta-reference in fiction. In general, meta-reference denotes the felt presence of a higher meta-level within an artwork from which statements about an object level are issued, ideally creating a meta-awareness in the recipient. Now, Werner Wolf distinguishes four analytical criteria, each eliciting a pair of opposing terms. This is rather technical, so I've got a slide for you. Regarding discernibility, meta-elements are either explicit or implicit. In terms of scope, they may be direct or indirect. In content, they either focus on the mediality or the truth-fiction status of work. And in function, they are either critical or non-critical, that is, illusion-breaking or not illusion-breaking. With this in hand, let's return to the fountain. Young Briney, meanwhile, reflects on what she has witnessed. She says she could write a scene like that one by the fountain, and she could include a hidden observer like herself. She could write the scene three times over from three points of view. 6 decades later, she would describe how at the age of 13 she had written her way through a whole history of literature to arrive at an impartial psychological realism which she had discovered for herself one special morning during a heat wave in 1935. She would be well aware of her self-mythologizing, and she gave her account a self-mocking or mock-heroic tone. On the story level, there's Briney's ironic epiphany about modernist narrative technique, and there are the notorious remarks about her later writing, which is obviously conspicuously similar to the narrative at hand. And we can classify this as first an explicit meta-reference and also indirect, because it is referring to other texts, not the one we're reading. On the level of discourse, as we've seen before, we get the simultaneous application of that technique which is discussed. And taken together, this produces an implicit, direct, meta-referential statement. While pretending to refer to the subtleties of fiction writing and their relevance for young Briney's future career as a writer, the text actually talks about itself. But crucially, this and other meta-referential elements in Briney's novel are by themselves non-critical in function and not aimed at its truth fiction status. In short, they have low illusion-breaking potential. However, the terminal mise en reflet that manifests in 1999 broaches the alleged fictionality of the whole of Briney's novel by enlisting the speech genres of the confession, the diary entry, and the prosaic Alltagsgeschichte, though London 1999 embellishes its statements about Briney's novel with discourses that are strongly associated with honesty, with truth. And this amounts to an implicit meta-statement about its own truthfulness. Atonement derives its tension not only from the inherent ambivalence of old Briney's remarks. As a complex utterance, it contains two contradictory utterances standing next to each other and both making claims to truth. Briney's novel, by its pleasing story of an almost absolute catastrophe averted, and London 1999 by its sober and surprising honesty. The interplay between these two parts creates further ambivalence. In a way, you want to believe both versions of events. In Wright's film, the narrative self-consciousness of the fountain scene is conveyed by Briney's sudden glance at us, at the camera, when after several shots establishing her point of view, like this one, so we get her, we get what she sees. It's an age-old filmic convention. And then she seems to be pondering what the hell all of this meant. And suddenly, she suggestively fixes her gaze on the camera position and respectively the viewer, us. And this is immediately followed by a cut back in time in order to witness the same events from Robbie's and Cecilia's point of view. Her glance at us, because we know she's alone, can be interpreted as an implicit metafilmic moment. But this is drawing attention, if at all, to the medium of film and not literature. Another attempt to convey an authorial presence is the sound of the typewriter. I won't say much about that. So it moves between being aligned with different diegetic and intradiegetic elements. So, but the meta-referential elements of the first part of Wright's Atonement are mostly indirect. At least there are no explicit references to its own medium, film. Except for that. That just came to my mind, except for that, which you said about the film thing. I forgot that scene. But indeed, Wright's young Briney is portrayed as an aspiring writer. And also his old Briney reveals in much clearer terms than in McCune the real fate of Robbie and Cecilia. Their deaths are even shown, despite their shown walking the cliffs of Rover afterwards. Right? However, viewers must believe that, viewers have to infer that what they had seen before was the film version of Briney's novel, which he talks about in the interview at the end. They must believe, however, that this is a realist novel. First, due to the strong denotational quality of the screen image and the general weak narrative transmission in film, and second, because it lacks the narrative self-consciousness and self-reflexivity that we find in McEwan's novel. The meta-referential elements that we find in Wright's Atonement are limited to the story level and are mostly indirect. The finale of Atonement, the film, does not elicit the kind of inner fictional re-centering we experience at the end of Atonement, the novel, when we realized that all that came before was actually a character's utterance and not the novel as such. This is supplemented, sort of finale, by the explicit metafilmic foregrounding of the mediality of the interview with old Briony, in which he seems to address the viewer as she speaks to the camera, gets this very close-up shot, if you remember. To conclude, McEwan's Atonement is a novel about the novel. Its larger part is a novel, and the other part deals mostly with questions related to the writing of a novel. And all of its discourse is suffused with echoes from literary history. It is, of course, also a novel about a writer, since it consists of two utterances of one and the same fictional author. And apart from that, it is concerned with, among other things, modernist aesthetics and the ethics of war fiction or historical novels and so on. But it is steering clear of talking about the type of novel itself belongs to, I would argue, postmodern type of novel that decides to do two things at once, immersing readers in a captivating narrative, but also exposing its fictionality. Wright's Atonement, on the other hand, is a film that doesn't reflect on its own medium, that deals with the ethics of fiction only on the story level and only related to the personal fate of Briney. War fiction or the reliability of literature in depicting reality are not at issue. It's a very definite story, in a way, not only due to the nature of film. McEwan's Atonement can be made to mean a whole lot of things. Let me give you here at the end, a maybe very daring reading of a passage from Bryony's novel, so with the first part of Atonement, that fundamentally contradicts my own interpretation from before, and by proposing that novelist Bryony actually invented her sister Cecilia and is indeed responsible for the design of Atonement. Trapped between the urge to write a simple diary account of her day's experience, I take this to refer to London 1999, and the ambition to make something greater out of them that would be polished, self-contained, and obscure, which would be Atonement. She sat, frowning at her infantile quotation, that is, the Trials of Arabella, or even the modernist opening of Atonement. Actions she could describe well enough, but how to do feelings? Even harder was the threat or the confusion of feeling contradictory things. At least that's how I felt after my first reading of Atonement. I claim this is now, here we do. We do have a mise en abîme very early in the text, which only at a second reading occurred to me. And I don't know whether I fully agree with myself here, but grant me this. You will not find such an elusive passage in Wright's Atonement. The image means what it means, basically. Conversely, no literary description will come close to the richness of the simultaneity of action and the multimedia density of information of Wright's depiction of the Dunkirk invasion. Whether you like it or not, you cannot describe so many things going on at the same time. So film and novel both have advantages and disadvantages, and these have far-reaching consequences for the question of the implied worldview of a work. Wright represents war. McEwan represents the representation of war. Wright depicts a novel, a novelist, and her story. McEwan depicts different modes of narrative transmission and tells the story of the making of a story. As attested by the diverging interpretations McEwan's Atonement has received, this is a very readerly text. Whereas you'll find it very easy to summarize the actual events of which Wright's Atonement is supposed to be a representation, McEwan's Atonement consistently refuses to answer the question of what really happened. Any translation from one medium to the other will necessarily not be able to convey the full meaning of its source, but also it cannot avoid creating new additional meaning. And for us, I believe this offers the possibility of having a look under the bonnet of both media to learn more about what they can do and what they cannot do. I think this is the real benefit of such a comparison, not the question of whether a transmedia translation was successful or not. And I will end my talk with another quote by James Monaco. The power of language systems is that there is a very great difference between the signifier and the signified. The power of film is that there is not. Thank you.